From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dirty Politics, we'll talk to political analyst Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She says that negative campaigning is playing on fears people don't discuss in public, like homophobia and racism. Also, we talk Russian politics with Kremlin insider Yorgi Arbatov. In 1967, he founded the Institute for the USA and Canada, the Soviet Union's most influential foreign policy think tank. He's been an advisor to every Soviet leader since the early 60s, from Khrushchev to Yeltsin. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new fall lineup, which doesn't actually start in the fall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tens of thousands of people along the central Gulf Coast have boarded up their homes and businesses and are moving to higher ground ahead of Hurricane Andrew. State emergency officials in Louisiana say mandatory evacuations have been ordered in the low-lying southern parishes of Louisiana, affecting about 200,000 people. It now appears that the storm will come ashore to the west of New Orleans, which could spare some of the most heavily populated areas. Bob Burpee is a meteorologist at the National Hurricane Center in Coral Gables, Florida.
In the last few hours, the maximum winds have remained rather steady. We're expecting the eye to go ashore in the early morning hours somewhere along the south central Louisiana coast. If it follows its track that we're predicting right now, it's heading for a less populated area than South Florida. The hurricane force winds would cover a larger area, but there are fewer people living in that area, so there would be less damage.
Meteorologist Bob Burpee at the National Hurricane Center in Coral Gables. The outer winds of Hurricane Andrew have now begun to buffet the southeast coast of Louisiana. NPR's John Burnett is there and has this report.
The images of the catastrophic destruction in South Florida gets people's attention, and this evening most Louisianans are taking no chances. By late afternoon, residents fleeing the lowland coastal towns were backed up bumper to bumper for 6 miles in Lafayette. Sheriff's offices in those wetland parishes, most of which are below sea level, have ordered a full-scale evacuation. Hotel rooms are filled the length of Interstate 10, which runs east to west through South Louisiana. Barges and freighters are at anchor beside the Mississippi River. Airports throughout South Louisiana have shut down. Even prisoners have been transferred to inland jails as everyone awaits the menacing gray clouds that cover the southern horizon. Said one sheriff's deputy, "I've never seen people in this city so scared about something." In Lafayette, Louisiana, I'm John Burnett.
Initial estimates of the hurricane damage in South Florida now run about $15 or $20 billion, according to officials in Dade County. The cost appears likely to exceed the cost of the damage caused by Hurricane Hugo around Charleston, South Carolina in 1989. That ran to almost $8 billion. Even though the estimates so far were for overall costs rather than insurance liability, the insurance companies are bracing for an unprecedented payout. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street, reflecting a dip in consumer confidence but higher sales of existing houses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,232. Declines led advances by a margin of about 10 to 7 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Federal medical workers in South Florida say they've already treated so many storm victims that they're running short of medical supplies. Two emergency medical teams are working in southern Dade County in the Florida Keys. The teams consist of civilian doctors, nurses, paramedics, and technicians. Federal officials say they don't have hard estimates of the numbers of casualties, but the teams are reporting many and calling for replenishment of their supplies. Arab and Israeli delegates to peace talks in Washington remain cautiously optimistic on the second day of the latest round of negotiations. Israeli delegates began discussions with their Syrian, Lebanese, and Jordanian counterparts yesterday and with the Palestinians today. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Palestinian spokesperson Hanan Ashrawi said today, "This time I think we do have a partner and we will get moving. a reference to Israel's new prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who has curtailed but not ended Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. He also favors regional elections for the Palestinians, but not a full-fledged legislature for them. Still, Ashrawi spoke today of points of convergence with the Israelis.
We take this as the beginning of the thread, and we are going to pursue it with the Israelis so that they will transform their statements of intent and all their good intentions to real substance.
And yet, even as she expressed some hope, Ashrawi acknowledged that huge gaps still remain between the Israeli and Palestinian positions. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Two new studies indicate that smoking is linked to cataracts, the leading cause of blindness. The studies show that people who smoke double their risk of forming cataracts, a condition in which the lens of the eye becomes clouded. Each year in the United States, 1 million surgeries are performed to remove cataracts. The two studies compared smoking and cataract statistics among more than 17,000 American male physicians. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Negative campaigning often works even when it's based on lies and distortions. My guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, is a communications analyst who has studied why negative campaigning is so effective and why deceptive negative ads are so difficult to counteract. She's the author of the new book, Dirty Politics: Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. Jamieson is also dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. She attended both the Republican and Democratic conventions and has been studying this year's negative campaigning. I realize that today may sound like NPR's salute to Kathleen Jamieson, since on some stations she was also coincidentally heard on the program Talk of the Nation. I spoke with her earlier today and asked her if the tactics used in negative ads are also used now in the general campaign.
The tactics of negative campaign ads actually came from regular campaigning. Historically, there's been a tendency in campaign discourse to simplify, to create artificial oppositions and artificial identifications, and then to identify your candidate with everything that's positive, your opponent with everything that's negative, and illegitimately contrast and compare. Those tactics move naturally from speeches, from the stump into advertising. They didn't move from advertising into the stump. But what advertising has done, particularly television advertising, is give the politician the ability to make those claims visual. And in the process of making those claims visual, what the candidate is able to do is to move with a speed that makes it hard for us to analyze what is being said. So I can juxtapose Hubert Humphrey's picture at the Democratic Convention of 1968 with Appalachian poverty so quickly that you're not likely to say, what are they doing together? And yet, you've now associated them in a way that means that the images have had an influence you might not have granted if I'd said, he's the cause of Appalachian poverty. He's indifferent to Appalachian poverty. He would tolerate Appalachian poverty.
There's an article in the New York Times today about how the Democrats are accusing the Republicans of using Hillary Clinton, working women in general, pro-choice women, and homosexuals as the new Willie Hortons. You've studied the Willie Horton ad. You've studied negative campaigning and negative advertising in general. Do you agree with the assertion?
The Horton claims in 1988 played on fears. The claims about liberated women, particularly the claims in the Marilyn Quayle speech, the claims about homosexuals, particularly the claims in the Buchanan speech, the claims about Hillary Clinton's positions on children's rights spread across the entire convention, play on fears. The Willie Horton instance was also based in factually inaccurate claims. The claims about Hillary Clinton's positions are factually inaccurate. The claim that Bill Clinton supports legalizing same-sex marriages is inaccurate. So to the extent that the Republican claims about working women, about Hillary Clinton, about gays, are playing on fears and based in factually inaccurate information, yes, there is a similarity.
You've studied the Willie Horton ad. Let's look at how that worked, how it worked psychologically on the people who watched it, because you even did focus groups to see what people took away from that Willie Horton campaign. Let's start with the information that was presented in it. What was accurate? What was inaccurate?
The Horton ad itself says that Horton stabbed a young man 19 times, killing him. Horton did not, as best we can tell, stab the young man. Instead, one of the people involved in the crime testified that Horton was in the car shooting up dope while the other two botched the robbery and killed the young man. If that is true, then what we have is a claim in the ad that's false. Horton did not kill the young man. Now, under Massachusetts law, he is nonetheless guilty of murder because he's an accessory to a felony murder. And so one can say he's a murderer. At least he's an accessory to a felony murder. He's convicted of first-degree murder. One cannot say he did the killing. But the larger inaccuracy in the use of Horton occurs when the Republican ad, the furlough ad that shows the supposed criminals revolving through a door, which is actually a turnstile, that ad amalgamates for us, invites us to amalgamate what we know of Horton with the claim in the ad that says many first-degree murderers escaped. Many went on to commit crimes like kidnapping and rape. Now, many first-degree murderers didn't escape. Four did in the 10 years that we had data on. Five actually did. One person escaped within the campaign year. Of those five, only one committed a violent crime, Horton. That is also the only black first-degree murderer who escaped. The most interesting of the cases the Republicans didn't use was a white cop who killed his business partner for the insurance money, his white business partner. Most murders are between people who know each other. Most murders are interracial. I'm sorry, most murders are within the same race. They're not between different races. And then this white cop went and killed another cop. And so what you had was a very inflammatory case that was available. The Republicans didn't use it. And when they were pressed in 88, the reason they said they used Horton was because he committed a violent crime. Horton is the only one who ever did who was a first-degree murderer.
I'm going to stop you right here because I think you've just illustrated a very important problem. What you're doing, in a way, is illustrating the problem of combating negative ads. Mm-hmm. To explain the false information in the Willie Horton ad requires, one, investigating the real story, which apparently mm-hmm. you did, and two, unraveling complicated information like what he was actually convicted of, what actually happened that we know at the scene of the crime, what was contested in the courtroom, who else was in the furlough program, and how did they do, and so on. It's complicated. It's much easier to just get this kind of visceral snapshot from an ad and form an impression than to actually sit down and examine the facts and sift through information and reconsider, you know?
And when the analytic information is offered, the statistical information is offered, against the atypical but dramatic and vivid personal case, Horton, people don't remember the statistical data and they don't believe that the case is atypical. We tend as individuals to generalize from single dramatic instances, particularly simple dramatic instances that play on our fears. Our fears say blacks kill whites, black men rape white women. What's the allegation against Horton? He killed a white young man. He raped a woman while on furlough, and the woman was white. And so out of the dramatic narrative, we have a coherent story that plays on deep-seated fears. We believe it's typical, and no statistical data will displace that. That's what we found in our focus groups. We offered one of our focus groups in Texas all the available evidence. The furlough program in Massachusetts had a 99.9% success rate. When you're given furloughs, you are more likely not to repeat crimes. You're more likely not to come back to a life of crime. That's the reason every state has a furlough program. That's the reason the federal government continues a furlough program. We laid all of this out. The only person to commit a violent crime, Horton, and then said to people who had said they were influenced by the story, what's your reaction? They said, none of that matters. And then they went back and replayed the Horton story for us. What we concluded was the appropriate way strategically for Michael Dukakis to counter Willie Horton was with an atypical instance of the Bush furlough program malfunctioning. There was one case during the Reagan-Bush years in which a convicted drug dealer jumped a work release transfer, which you could call a furlough. In fact, the federal government does call it a type of furlough, and raped and murdered the pregnant Hispanic mother of two. When we said to our focus groups, now let's talk about this instance, this vicious drug dealer whom George Bush says he'd like to execute, manages to get out of a federal furlough and kills not just a woman, he kills the pregnant mother of two. Now you could displace Willie Horton, but look what you've done. You've now taken demagoguery to pit against demagoguery, taken an atypical instance against an atypical instance, and the discussion has now degenerated to futility. And lost in the process is a reasoned discussion of the reason for furloughs and the relationship between furloughs and reduction in crime.
Well, since you agree that some of the same principles that were at work in the Willie Horton campaign are now at work in how the Republicans are trying to smear Hillary Clinton and working women and pro-choice women and homosexuals, what do you think the Democrats should do to counter that?
As an academic who would like to see discourse elevated, I would like to believe that laying in place the context for the Hillary Clinton statements and the historical trajectory of those arguments would establish convincingly to people that Hillary Clinton is in the mainstream. Her positions are not controversial. Indeed, they are the norms for behavior in courts now. As a person who studied this, I know that won't work. Michael Dukakis tried that in 1988 when he said, here are the Supreme Court rulings that I relied on in saying I wouldn't mandate the Pledge of Allegiance in classrooms. And he was basically skewered on the assumption that he was unpatriotic, he didn't want little children to say the pledge. Strategically, what my research would suggest is the way for the Democrats to effectively get rid of the Republican charge is to say the Republicans favor having little children tied to radiators, sexually abused and starved with no legal recourse because they don't believe that children under 18 are entitled to lawyers. Now, look what that recommendation does. It takes the worst-case scenario, the non-representative case, and pits it against the evocative claim that 12-year-olds will be permitted to sue for their allowance. The discourse isn't advancing in a useful way if the Democrats respond that way, but in fact, that's the way that will work, and that's the problem with the discourse of campaigns.
In your book, you said that the Willie Horton ads played on fears without stating what those fears were. Mm-hmm. And that's a tactic of a lot of negative campaign mm-hmm. ads. Do you see that at work now in how working women and homosexuals are being portrayed?
The claims at the Republican convention that Bill Clinton would approve same-sex marriages basically overstates the Clinton position substantially and plays on fears that are not ever discussed in the public domain. Bill Clinton says what he favors is non-discrimination in employment, and he favors access to the military for those who are avowedly gay. He has not taken a position about sanctifying, that's the Republican word, same-sex marriages. The problem with the Republican claim that he would approve same-sex marriages is that it plays on fears that no one discusses. When you say you oppose same-sex marriages and you are a conservative fundamentalist Republican, what are you actually saying? You're claiming that you're afraid that you're going to have children adopted into a same-sex relationship, that you've set up a role model for what the fundamentalists consider an alternative lifestyle that is inappropriate. That claim is usually conjoined with a second claim, which is the Democrats would mandate gay teachers in the classroom. What that implies but does not say is pedophilia. It suggests that gays are necessarily rapacious and predatory. Now, usually the image that's called up is of the male teacher in the elementary classroom. The number of male teachers in elementary classrooms is very small. Why not? Now, equally often, or more often, since heterosexuals make up 90% of the population, fear that what you're going to have are heterosexual males preying on little girls. But there's a fear that is not discussed. The base in evidence is never put forward. So instead of asking, how likely is it that a gay teacher is going to molest the children in her or his charge in a school, we simply play out the unspoken fear, mandating gay teachers. We also suggest that if you have a gay teacher in the classroom, what you're going to have is advocacy of a gay lifestyle for children and the assumption that a gay lifestyle is contagious. And then finally, there's the fear of AIDS. Now, what is interesting about all of this is the unspoken pedophilia, you know, molesting children, advocating homosexuality being contagious, The whole notion that what you may have here is a subtle means of transmitting AIDS will never be spoken in the public discourse. If they were spoken in the public discourse, we would have a chance to turn to the experts and say, is that what happens? What are the percents? How likely is that? Is there ever a conceivable circumstance in which a teacher would transmit AIDS to a student? In the process, if we could get this into the public domain, people would have a chance to examine their fears.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kathleen Hall Jamison, and she's the author of the new book, Dirty Politics, Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's an expert on political campaigns and a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the new book, Dirty Politics. We are living in a climate in which it would be totally unacceptable for a candidate to get up and say, I believe all black people in America are inferior and should not be granted their civil rights. Now, you might use code words to play on people's racist fears, but those racist fears would definitely be unexpressed in a real concrete way. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get away with it, no matter how racist you were. You can, however, get up and say that you think homosexuals should not be given civil rights. Mm-hmm. Why can you get away with that with one group and not another?
Part of what I look at in Dirty Politics is the history of scapegoating in presidential campaigns. And what I think is clear in the ways in which we've treated, for example, Catholics and the way in which we've treated blacks is that over a long period of time, extended discourse exposes the substance of the fears. And extended experience with the scapegoated group suggests the fears are illegitimate. Part of what the gay rights movement has done is legitimized individuals coming forward and saying, yes, I am gay. And to the extent that in the workplace, in the neighborhood, at church, individuals are now having experience with people who seem very much like them in fundamental ways and are realizing this person is gay, we are moving into the transitional period in which it is far more difficult to vilify gays than it was before you could make those identifications.
The Bush campaign is using a degree of negative campaigning to attack the Democrats, describing the Democrats' platform as being like Woody Allen's personal life and so on. Clinton maintains he's trying to run a positive campaign. What do you think? Do you think he is running a, quote, positive campaign?
Clinton is running a positive campaign more so than are the Republicans, if what you look at for negativity and positivity, if there's such a word, is attack on person rather than attack on policy. But if you ask how many lines in the speeches of Bill Clinton attack the policies and the record of George Bush, you would say that the two campaigns are comparably oppositional. Our tendency, however, is not to think that attacks on policy are negative, but rather to think that attacks on groups and on persons are. And so many people hear the attacks that are characterized as family values attacks as negative simply by virtue of their nature, where they don't hear the public policy attacks as being negative by their nature. And what is interesting about the distinction is this. We don't yet have a clear answer to the question, what's relevant to governance about the character of the person who would be president? The Republicans are gambling that ultimately before you cast a vote, you ask, do I trust this person? Is the character of this candidate acceptable to me morally, ethically, and on whatever dimensions I as a person value? The Democrats are assuming that we go into the voting booth and say, what public policies matter to me? Basically, the two campaigns, in other words, are contesting on different grounds, and they have a different view of how voters make voting decisions.
Well, from your research, which view is more accurate?
Depends on how troubled the economy is. If we walk into the voting booth in early November perceiving that the economy is not picking up, the future is not brighter and better, we are more likely to value the public policy positions on the economy of the person out of power. If the economy appears to be picking up, and our faith in George Bush's economic strategy is revivified, then the character dimension is going to be salient, because basically what we're going to say is, who do I trust to do all those things we haven't talked about that we can't even anticipate that may happen in the first term of this person I'm now putting in the Oval Office? Bush is gambling on the latter scenario. Clinton's gambling on the former.
If you put on an ad with false claims in it for a product, the Federal Trade Commission will make you take the ad off or correct the information. If you put on a political ad that is based on completely false claims, nobody's going to make you take it off or make you correct it. The press will try to correct it on their news shows or in the newspaper, but the ad can continue to run. Do you think that there should be some kind of formal way of regulating campaign ads?
No, I don't. And that's not because I'm not offended by much of what I see in political advertising. It rather is a fear rooted in history. Prior to the regulation of broadcasting that required that a candidate's ads be aired, the station owners of radio routinely turned down the ads of the candidates they didn't favor. Now, since station owners tended to be Republicans, that meant the Democratic ads were routinely quashed. But the larger question that's raised when one says, let's keep all ads that lie off the air, is who do you trust to determine whether an ad is lying? Who do you trust to be so unbiased and so fair that that person wouldn't be playing games with the political process? What is unfortunate is that many people believe that because an ad airs on television, it must have gone through some screening process and it must, as a result, be true. The service we can provide is to remind viewers that an ad can lie outrageously. The station can know it is lying. And if the station has permitted one candidate for that office to buy time, it must permit all comparable candidates to buy time. And it may not censor the ad unless the ad violates the time limits that have been purchased, the technical requirements of the station, the sound breaks up in the ad, or the ad is obscene. It shows a copulating couple, for example. No, you can't do that. Or it doesn't have the disclaimer at the end that says who sponsored it. Those are the only reasons a station can reject an ad.
Kathleen, would you ever like to get into campaign managing yourself? You know so much about campaigning and politics and the way it's practiced in America.
No. There's a role for the academic community in the campaign process. And I worry when my colleagues move in and out of campaign consulting.
Why?
Because what the academic community should do is stay as genuinely nonpartisan as it can and stay focused on the process, not the individuals involved in the process. And so I see my role and the role of my colleagues who study political communication as asking how we talk to the public and to the press about making the system work more effectively. Now, if my agenda were electing George Bush, I would write a very different book than I would if my focus were on trying to determine how a campaign best helps the electorate understand the issues and helps ensure that campaigns have relevance to governance.
Have you ever been approached by a campaign?
Yes, I've been approached by campaigns on both sides. It's interesting to play the role that I do because Democrats assume that I'm a Democrat except when I attack their candidates' campaign strategy or their communication. Republicans assume I'm a Republican except when I attack them. And while they're assuming that I'm with them, I occasionally get asked if I'd like to work for them or give them advice, and I always say no.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking to us about the campaign. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is the author of Dirty Politics and the dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Soviet politics from an insider's perspective. Yorgi Arbatov founded the Institute for the USA and Canada, the Soviet Union's most influential foreign policy think tank. We'll talk about his role as advisor to every Soviet leader since the early 60s, from Khrushchev to Yeltsin. This fall, there are a record 35 new series premiering on the networks. TV critic David Bianculli previews the new fall lineup, which has already started, even though it's not September yet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Hurricane Andrew is expected to move ashore again around midnight. And all along the Gulf Coast, residents have been moving today to higher ground, either urged to do so or ordered to. The storm is now some 105 miles south of New Orleans and moving northwest at 13 miles an hour. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Evacuations have been called in the low-lying areas along the Texas coast, southeast of Houston. Residents in those areas are boarding up their homes and stocking up on provisions to either sit the storm out at home or head north away from Andrew's path. In all areas, the best officials can do is recommend evacuations. Texas law does not allow anyone to be forced to leave their homes. But Galveston County Emergency Coordinator Don Wiseman is confident that those who need to leave will.
The folks down there are quite ready to do the things that are proper, you know, in these kinds of circumstances. I don't think we have a great concern about the public's lack of response or not heeding the information or so on and so forth.
Mainly because these residents have been through hurricanes before. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
The full force of Hurricane Andrew is expected to bypass New Orleans with landfall expected west of the city, although the path of the storm could change over the next several hours. NPR's John Burnett reports that one Louisiana town, located on higher ground, has accepted many evacuees.
This is sort of a collection point. Lafayette is for a lot of these lowland parishes to the south, and they've brought prisoners up here. They've brought some patients from hospitals up here. They have a huge sports complex called a Cajun Dome, and it is completely full with 1,000 people, and it's spilling over into various elementary schools. And so this town is really full of people trying to escape this storm right now.
NPR's John Burnett. Miami's International Airport opened again late this afternoon for limited domestic and international traffic. The airport is a key transfer point for passengers and cargo on the way to Latin America and is one of the busiest in the nation. A spokesman says that international cargo traffic will not resume for the foreseeable future. Traffic had been halted Sunday night a few hours before Hurricane Andrew slammed into southern Florida. Officials in Florida say the death toll from Hurricane Andrew is at least 12 people, and that figure is expected to go higher as rescue work continues. The storm caused at least $15 billion in damage as it swept across southern Florida. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 4 points to close at 3,232.22 on volume of more than 202 million shares. This is NPR News. Top Red Cross officials have warned that huge international food shipments to Somalia need to be better supervised, or there could be more violence in that war-damaged nation. The Red Cross says nearly a dozen of its workers have been killed over the last week, and with large quantities of food arriving in an uncontrolled fashion, this could set off new security problems. U.S. airlifts begin this week, and Germany plans additional aid. U.S. officials have said that it's likely that Red Cross workers will handle food shipments, but the Red Cross says, if that's the case, the planes cannot have U.S. markings or carry weapons. Despite continued Arab concerns, the U.S. and its allies are set to impose a no-fly zone in southern Iraq to protect the Shiite Muslim population living there from Baghdad's attacks. President Bush is expected to make that announcement tomorrow. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Under the plan, Iraqi planes flying south of the 32nd parallel would risk being shot down by the Allies. Iraqi officials took a tough line today in public, claiming they would defy the no-fly order. But Pentagon officials said Iraq had moved most of its planes and helicopters out of the southern region in the past few days, indicating Baghdad was unlikely to directly challenge the order. Egypt and Syria have expressed concerns the Allied plan could inadvertently lead to the breakup of Iraq. Iran has been aiding the Shiites in the south, and the U.S. has urged Iran not to take advantage of the protective umbrella to try to expand its influence there. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The Conference Board says that consumer confidence dropped again this month after a similar decline in July. The Private Business Research Group says its Consumer Confidence Index, which uses 1985 as a base of 100, fell 3 points to 58. The board says consumers are more negative in their view of present economic conditions. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Yorgi Arbatov, has written an insider's view of Soviet politics. He describes himself as not a dissident or an enemy of the system, but as someone who has lived and willingly worked within it. Arbatov is best known to American political analysts as Russia's leading expert on the United States. In 1967, he founded an institute devoted to studying the U.S. and Canada. Arbatov has been a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party and the Supreme Soviet. He advised six Soviet leaders, from Khrushchev to Yeltsin. Arbatov's institute often hosted American political experts. In the introduction to Arbatov's new book, The System, journalist Strobe Talbert writes, "Arbatov and his colleagues were on the whole gracious and helpful, but they were also our sparring partners in what were often rather tedious and exasperating debates." Arbatov thinks of himself as one of the people who helped reform the Soviet Union by working within the system. Soviet dissidents have been celebrated in the West. I asked him if he thinks the contributions of insiders like himself have been overlooked.
I am sure it was the dissidents were so easy to recognize, and I don't want to deny that many of them, not all of them, but many of them were not only honest, but very people with courage, with guts, who really could risk and were ready to risk. But, you know, there were a handful with very, very small influence. But in addition, there were thousands and thousands of people who worked from within, who tried to make the change, and who had also to risk, not to such degree as dissidents, but they had to risk their career, their well-being, their reputation. And anyway, they did the major work. It started not because of the dissidents, the perestroika and Gorbachev and all of it. It started because the situation became ripe inside of the country. Dissidents helped to do it to some degree, but this, you know, influence from without couldn't do the thing alone. It was absolutely necessary to have efforts on both sides.
In your memoir, you write, you cannot demand the self-sacrifice of a Sakharov, of everyone. Now, your father was imprisoned under Stalin for counter-revolutionary behavior. What was the lesson you got out of your father's imprisonment?
Oh, I got it even before, and I write, I think, about it there. I learned it as a young boy, actually. I was still in high school, that one can be arrested without any guilt and even destroyed. A lot of friends of my father, of my parents, and a lot of, parents of my friends were arrested, disappeared, perished in prison. And I learned at this time still that you can become a victim without committing any crime.
So you must have grown up, though, really, like, hating and fearing the system before you ended up working within it. I mean, it just seems you'd have to hate a system that unjustly imprisoned your own father.
Well, you know, I didn't understand that the system imprisoned my father. I understood, like many people otherwise, maybe it was a compromise with your own intellect, but you had to come to peace with this life. So you explained to yourself that these are distortions, gross distortions made by some villains who got to the leading positions, and there were some good things, etc. And I would say that you cannot paint the past, though it was mostly very, very, I would say, cruel and unjust, but you cannot paint it only one black color, you know. This was the period of when people become literate. After the revolution, immediately 80% of our population was illiterate. When there was development, spectacular development of our science and of many fields of our art, everything was not so one-sided and so easy. And we could, I fought, you know, I fought for this country. It is not for this system, but for my country. For my country, I fought against Hitler, and we were allies in this time, and I have a clear consciousness in this sense.
Now, you became the Soviet Union's leading scholar of American politics. What got you interested in America?
You know, I became sick in 1944. I had was seriously sick and was honorably discharged from the army. And I was, at this time, 21 year old. I was a retired captain. And I had to think, what will I do in the future? So I went to university, to the Department of International Relations, and then we had to make another choice, what country to pick out for study. And I think at this time it was very natural that I picked out United States. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting country, it was our ally, and all of us had hopes that this alliance will overlive the war and our victory, which I'm sorry to say, was not so, turned out to be different.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Yorgi Arbatov, who is the head of Russia's Institute on the United States and Canada. He's considered Russia's leading Americanist, and he's written a new memoir called The System, An Insider's Life in Soviet Politics. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yorgi Arbatov, a Russian scholar of American politics, and for years he was a key insider in the Soviet system and advised several Soviet leaders, including Gorbachev, Brezhnev, Andropov.
And Yeltsin.
And Yeltsin, that's right. Now he's advising Yeltsin. Well, you write that in the 1950s the Communist Party realized its need for intellectuals to prepare positions and arguments, to improve the art of persuasion, and to make the party's point of view more attractive at home and abroad. Now, was that your primary role and how you saw yourself as an intellectual?
No, I was never had you know, assignment to participate in propaganda. And in this sense, I think my image is not not correct here in this country. They think that I was the spokesman, that I had to somehow to persuade people here, to be an agent of influence, etc., which is wrong. What I did here, speaking in media, writing articles, etc., it was completely on my own risk, and quite a few times I got into trouble. My assignment was to study the country and to report about my institute's political analysis.
What's an example of something you got into trouble for?
Well, for instance, in 1978, I have written an article in Newsweek, and there I ended with a sentence which sounded approximately like this, that, you know, I was during the war fighting at the front, but I returned home. Oh, excuse me. My father was participating in civil war, but he returned home. I participated in the Second World, I returned home. If there will be another war, there will nobody will remain to return home. You cannot win. You cannot wage nuclear war. Few years later, it became official policy of both countries, mine and yours. But at this time, it was heresy. And I was really criticized more than once, etc.
Which is once verbal criticism?
Verbal, but very serious one from the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the militaries were dissatisfied with it. Another time I mentioned that we have also military-industrial complex. And it was reported, it was at a meeting and with Americans, it was reported in the press. I had again some troubles. But I was very calm about these troubles. I took it as part of small risk of the job. And you have either to be honest or you have to quit the job.
Did being a scholar of the West ever make you want to leave the Soviet Union for the United States or Canada, the two countries that you are studying, because in part of the greater intellectual freedom in those two countries?
To be honest, I envy it sometimes, part of the freedom. On the other side, I see also limitation to the freedom of my colleagues here, which are a different kind. It is not censorship, but it is obedience to some of the other set of rules of the game, of what is tolerated by the establishment and the society, and they are also rather careful. But I never had a wish to flee. You know, of course, would it be threat to my life and life of my family, maybe I would think it differently. And the first time I thought about it was during the coup, that if fascism comes to my country, I will have to flee, if I can. But in this situation, you mostly cannot do it. Otherwise, I always wanted to stay in the country. It's my country, and I have to share its destiny, and I don't want to leave.
We're hearing President Bush in this presidential campaign take a lot of credit for ending the Cold War. From your perspective, how much credit does President Bush deserve?
For winning the Cold War or for ending the Cold War?
For ending the Cold War.
Well, quite honestly, it was done already before he became the president. And the initiative belonged to us. And I'm proud about it. I think the Nobel Prize Committee was very correct to give the Nobel Prize for Peace to Gorbachev. But I would say that it was good that President Reagan followed the lead. And then President Bush picked it up and now pursues a policy which is consistent with this.
You know, for years you were the scholar of the Soviet Union's enemy. Now you're the scholar of the country that the Soviet Union would like to have aid from. And I wonder if that's changing your position within Russia and to changing what people want from you.
You know, I don't regard United States as an enemy for quite a while already, and I understood that there is a sort of a mirror, law of mirror reflection in policy. If you do something bad, the other side will follow you. If you do something good, maybe the other side will pick it out also. And therefore, I think the policy begins at home always, also foreign policy. And I thought since we changed our policy, I was hopeful, and these hopes were not groundless, that United States will also change their policy. As to cooperation, you know, I wouldn't ask United States for money. I think this is not only humiliating, but it is wrong. What we need from United States, I think it is consistent foreign policy, which makes it possible for us to disarm, to spend less and less on armaments. I think it will be useful for both sides. And the other thing, we need your know-how. We are building a new economy, which has to be market economy, and here we have a close to zero experience, and you have a lot of experience. I think here you could help us a lot in working out program, in training our specialists, etc.
If you had your way, would the Communist Party still exist, but a reformed version of it?
You know, my opinion was for quite a while already that the Communist Party has to split. At least the social democratic part of it should form an independent social democratic party. The communists should remain. Maybe there will be some other groups. And this was in the debates in the inner circle for since maybe 87, 88. And would Gorbachev have guts to do it? I think we would have maybe more normal transitional period and much better successes in economic reform and in democratic development as well.
You, over the years, spoke on a lot of American TV shows, giving your perspective and the Soviet point of view in debates about international politics. Of the TV shows that you've done over the years, which did you find to be the most comfortable for you, and which were you the most cautious about going on because you felt you wouldn't be treated fairly?
You see, I was ready to do it again. It was on my own risk, practically in almost all programs. I wouldn't go to Evans and Novak, for instance.
You wouldn't
or
go
McLaughlin's
to
group.
Okay, McLaughlin, what was the first? I'm sorry, what was the first one that you mentioned?
Evans and Novak.
Oh, okay.
They are just crying at each other. I prefer programs where one can, like with you, you have some time, you can explain yourself, and even if the other side disagrees, but both of you can put down your arguments in a proper way. I dislike the short morning news, you know, because you have to get very early. You go there, you prepare yourself, then you have 1 minute and a half, and then this is out. And you are very often asked an absolutely irrelevant question.
Have you given a lot of advice over the years to other Russians about how to express themselves on American television?
You know, I never was regarded as an expert on public relations or something like this, but just because I had good relations with some of the leaders, I dared to give them advice. For instance, I told Gorbachev more than once to be not so long-winded and to give a chance to the journalists to ask him questions at the press conferences. And so sometimes I have given advice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking to us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Yorgi Arbatov directs the Institute for the USA and Canada in Russia. He's the author of the new book, The System, An Insider's Life in Soviet Politics. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, we'll have an update on Hurricane Andrew, which is now threatening the Gulf Coast. We'll find out about evacuation efforts in Louisiana, and we'll also have reports on the damage that the hurricane caused in Florida. President Bush and Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton spoke today to the American Legion Convention in Chicago. We'll have a report on those speeches from Chicago. And we'll also have a profile of the Muslim community of Bosnia-Herzegovina. These are the people who are the target of Serbia's ethnic cleansing. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli was in Bosnia recently, and she'll have that profile for us on today's program.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli has some things to report about the start of the new TV season. You say it's too early in the year to do that? Well, so does he.
Before I start ranting, let me play a clip from Covington Cross, a new ABC series premiering tonight. It stars Nigel Terry, who played King Arthur in the movie Excalibur. In this show, he plays a single father trying to raise four grown teenagers, and his house is his castle. Literally, because the show takes place in the Middle Ages, even though it's got a very modern slant. In this scene, Terry and his daughter, played by Ione Skye, argue over a prearranged marriage contract.
How could you?
I had no choice, Eleanor.
You could have said no. That's a choice.
It's not that simple.
How complicated can it be? I don't even know this man. I certainly don't love him.
I didn't know your mother before I married her. Now, When did love ever have anything to do with a marriage contract?
Well, it should, and it will for me.
My marriage was arranged. So was my father's and his father's before him. It's always been this way.
Well, it's wrong.
Covington Cross is a very unusual idea for a weekly series, and it certainly looks different than anything else on the air. And that's the point. It's also why the series is starting a full month before the fall season's supposed to start. Anything that can help a show stand out, whether it's castles and swords or a four-week head start, is fair game in 1992. And though Covington Cross is worth sampling, especially in the slow days of August, I'd actually rather wait. Now, I don't mean to make this a walking 5 miles in the snow to school story, but when I was a kid, TV was simpler. Not better, but simpler. There were only 3 networks then, and no cable networks. Every year, the new TV season started on the third week of September, which is when Detroit would unveil its new line of cars and launch major advertising campaigns around the new and returning shows. A big part of this ancient TV ritual was the fall preview issue of TV Guide, which ran pictures and descriptions of the new shows and a schedule of the new season. And that was it. Shows ran half a year and were repeated the other half. If you liked a show, you knew where to find it. If you didn't, if it was a real clunker like My Mother the Car, you just had to be patient because the network would replace it at the earliest opportunity, which in those days meant next season. These days, things are nuts. Old shows are moved around like pinballs, and new ones, instead of getting an order for 26 or 22 episodes, try to make their mark in 4 to 6 weeks. And these new shows are competing for attention not only with the established shows and with all the alternatives on cable and public TV, but with each other. This fall, there are a record 35 new series premiering on CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox. The odds are that only 3 or 4 of them will survive for a second season. Coincidentally, there are only about 3 or 4 of them that are worth watching. And unfortunately, the new shows that survive, and the new shows that are any good, are by no means the same ones. But because the networks are desperate to get you to sample their new shows, they're all trying to get a head start, or to hold back and wait until a lot of the fighting is over. So we have some fall shows that premiered even before Covington Cross, CBS's Raven and Fox's Melrose Place, and others that won't show up until October, like Fox's Class of 96 and Key West. And though mid-September is still the official start of the TV season, half of the new shows will have premiered prior to premiere week. That includes Covington Cross, as well as 2 other shows premiering later this week, Fox's Martin and The Heights. I'm in no particular hurry to review those shows either, though. Unlike the networks, I can wait. I've got a vacation to take.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. See you when you get back from vacation, David. Have a good one. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Family values have become one of the biggest issues of the presidential campaign. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet a lobbyist devoted to keeping family values on the agenda. My guest will be Robert Knight of the Family Research Council. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.